The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network. Meditation doesn't have to be a solo practice. Meditation is more fun with friends. Looking for a way to drop in and hang out at the same time? Join us online at Omega Institute for a meditation party with self-proclaimed meditation nerds Dan Harris, host of the 10% Happier podcast, Sebene Selassie, and Jeff Warren. This three-day retreat will stream live from Omega's Hudson Valley campus May 17th to 19th. Don't miss the party. Reserve your spot at eomega.org/party today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Radiate Wellness Podcast. I'm your host, Christy Clemens Hoffman. Each week, we will discuss tools, tips, and ways to radiate your best life ever, interviewing practitioners, authors, and luminaries to help you on your path. Wellness, joy, peace, abundance. What do you want to radiate?
Hi, and welcome to the Radiate Wellness Podcast. Today, I'm joined by David Ditchfield to radiate self-love. I've been giddy excited about this interview. David had a horrible, a horrific train accident, was dragged under a train, and as you can imagine, it was very traumatic, and as a result, had a near-death experience. That was also very transformative and actually completely changed David's life, gave him new abilities and new insights that were previously unknown. Welcome, David. I am so happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me along. Great to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I've been so excited about this. And of course, you've written a book that I do want to talk about after we talk a bit about your experience, but your book is Shine On, and it's due to come out June 26th, is that
That's
correct?
That's right, yeah. So, yeah, a couple of weeks now.
June 26th, 2020. And that will be available wherever fine books are sold, as they say. And I do want to touch on that. But so first of all, I don't even know where to start, really. I guess we could just start with your life before this accident. Yeah, and I've been reading your book. Mm-hmm. Your prospects were not glowing, I suppose you could
That's
say.
That's right, yeah.
What was your life like before this?
Well, I mean, basically, I'd left school without any qualifications because I'm dyslexic, actually, and I wasn't diagnosed with that when I was at school. So I was treated as lazy and and uncooperative, which was not true at all, actually. But having that label around your shoulders is quite a big one, and you carry it through life. So I moved down to London and I was living in London for some time. And obviously, like all capital cities, it's very competitive and an expensive place to live. And the only kind of work I could really pick up was mostly manual labouring, which was great. I met some amazing people who are really skilled at their work, and I wasn't. So I wasn't fitting in there either. I just suddenly realised, oh my goodness, where do I fit in? Because this is not working for me, you know. My life was really kind of, I was just chasing after all the wrong goals as well to try and fix my life, I think is the best way of putting it. I was drinking quite heavily, it has to be said. A lot of that was due to the fact that the way of picking up work was basically going to the local bar, to the local pub, and you go there each evening and hang out and try and hustle work off the guys who ran the sites, you know, and you'd end up spending all your day's wages. anyhow, that's another story. But things were just going pretty pretty bad for me, to be honest with you, up until the point of my accident. So, yeah.
And then before your accident, you had an amazing experience at the Spiritualist Church.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That was interesting, actually, because spirituality hadn't really entered my life at all. You know, I didn't really think about it. As I say, I was just trying to live by the day, as it were. And I wasn't really, I didn't think about death or the afterlife or spirituality. But it was by chance. I was on the train going up to visit my sister and her family who live in Cambridge. And I was on the way up, and there was an elderly couple sat opposite me. And the lady there got chatting to me just about, you know, where's the next station, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then she said, oh, we're off to see a medium tonight. I went, okay. And she was quite insistent on talking about this. She said, she's very good. She said, she's absolutely the best. And I was going, fantastic, you know. And then she handed me this flyer, like a small poster. I said, here, take this. And I said, no. She said, no, take it. So I folded it up, put it in my pocket, and forgot all about it. And when I arrived at my sister's house, there was quite a lot of mayhem going on at the time, because you got young boys at the time, and she was looking after them. So I said, look, I'm going to go and have a drink, go to the local bar, which I did. And as I sat there, I pulled this flyer out of my pocket and looked at it. And I thought, do you know what? I'm going to give this a go. I'm going to go and find out what this is about, you know. And I was curious, you know. And so I went, but only curious from the point of view that from the show, I thought it'd be a good show, not kind of, wow, this is a spiritual opening for me. Anyhow, it was the event took place at a local spiritualist church, a beautiful little church. And I walked through the door and it was packed. And I got myself a seat, sat down on my own. And this lady came out called Julia Knight, who was this brilliant, she was a brilliant medium, and she was just like pacing backwards and forwards and picking up these messages, it seemed, from somewhere else and talking to these. She was going, yeah, okay, I've got it, you know. It was all like this, and very animated. And she was brilliant picking out people and saying, you know, picking up relatives who passed on, that people had come to find out about their loved ones. And then she suddenly turned around and said, gentleman over there in the blue sweater, I went, oh, that's me, kind of thing. And she said, yes, she said, your life is about to change. And I went, okay. And I said, in what way? And she said, and she started talking again to these guys. And she said, they're not telling me. They're just saying it's going to be very big and be ready for it. I went, oh, right. So clearly, in my mind, I was thinking, I'm going to win the lottery. You know, I'm going to get the girl that I was after and have that wonderful relationship and live happily ever after, you know. So all those thoughts were going through my head, but that wasn't the case at all. And I later realized that the big change in my life was about to be something completely different. Yeah.
Very, very different. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, so this was, I think you said 2014?
2006, yeah.
2006. Oh, that was a long time ago.
I know, yeah. Well, because of my dyslexia, that's why it's taken me a while to get around to writing this book. But I'm there. I've done it, and it's coming out.
Yeah. Well, you've done just an admirable job. I should say, I've been looking through an advanced copy of it, and just, I like how you tell the story. You jump forward, you circle back. It's a bit jumping around, because I'm sure that's how it unfolds in your mind. It's like, well, wait a minute, this happened, but then there was this, but that we have to go back and explain why that happened.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's an interesting way to tell the story, but it's very effective. And of course, this accident happened. I couldn't help but notice it was 2006, kind of because of a girl.
Well, she was part of the story, yeah, you know, and just like everything is, you know, I now realize that synchronicity is all part of our, you know, of our journey. And I'd met this girl only a couple of weeks prior to the accident and the near-death experience itself. And so what happened was we just kind of, it was a chance meeting in a bar, funny enough, and she was in there, and we got chatting, and we just had this connection, and it was this really lovely connection, and we just got it, you know. And What had happened was, roll forward a few months after I'd been to the Spiritualist Church for that medium appointment, things had gone rapidly downhill. And my sister said, look, you're in a pretty bad way. I think you need to come and stay with us and get out of London. And you know, I was broke by then. I couldn't pay my bills or anything. So off I went, packed my bags. So I was staying there for a couple of weeks, which was lovely, and hanging out with her family. And this friend who I'd met, called Anna, said, oh, can I come and see you? I said, yeah, sure. So she came up for a couple of days and we had a really beautiful time together. And then she had to get back to London. So I went to the train station to see her off. And when we arrived at the station, I helped her on the carriage with her bags and gave her a hug and a kiss. And then we heard the emergency buzzers going for the doors to close. And she was going, come on, you've got to get off. I was going, yeah, I'm going, don't worry. And so I stepped back. And as I did, the bottom top corner of my coat, because it was a February day, a cold day, got trapped in the closing doors, the automatic doors. And I was there on the platform. I just couldn't free it. I just tugged really hard and nothing was happening. So I looked around to see, you know, look for a guard on the platform, and there was no one there, nobody at all. In fact, there was just one other guy and he said, take your coat off, mate, take it off. And that just wasn't going to happen because it was like a very thick quality coat. And I just thought, there's no way it's going to just slip off. So then I realized, I thought, this, I'm not getting, the engine started to rev up at that point. And I remember just hitting, banging on the windows, hoping that a guard would come running through on the actual train itself. But that didn't happen either. I was just shouting for help and everything. And I just looked into the eyes of this girl, Anna, and we just looked at each other. And I just thought, this is it. I'm going to die. I didn't think I was going to survive because I knew I wasn't going to get free. So the train just started pulling out the station and at terrific speed. It's amazing. You don't realize just how fast they accelerate. You know, when you're sat on a train, you don't think about it, but they really do. And I could feel the gears going through one by one. And then I lost my footing eventually. And then I was dragged along the platform and then through the space of the platform edge and the actual train itself. And then I was just pulled under. And then I was just... It was like going into like this other world, which is really a horrible one, a really dark and frantic, and it was all very violent. I was tossed around, you know, and banged around all over the place. And it was just, really, I was completely conscious throughout this whole ordeal as well. So it was very frightening.
Oh my goodness. I can't even imagine. I'm sure time felt like it was just slowing down so much. And
it did, yeah.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I can't even remember. You deal with a fair amount of PTSD from this still too.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's just one of those things, you know. It's just one thing I realized from all this, and even my consultant said to me at the time that there's only so much that we know about the brain and the body and how it all works. And I really don't think that, you know, the human mind and body should be subjected to something as violent and as horrific as that and survive it, you know. So ultimately you are going to have this kind of post-traumatic stress disorder, which does stay with you, you know. So I've had to deal with that, but I went for quite a lot of therapy, which I totally believe in. I love, you know, therapy is fantastic. I've had all different types of therapy, but it's inevitable, really. It happens to all of us. Yeah.
Well, in addition to the trauma, of course, the physical trauma, the emotional trauma, the mental trauma, your body suffered just so much trauma. Yeah. What was the extent of your injuries?
Well, the main thing that I suffered from the worst was my left arm was severed from the elbow down. So that was pretty horrible.
It was severed?
It was just kind of cut from, you know, from the elbow down, and there was still part of it was just still attached, so they were able to save it. In fact, when I arrived in the hospital, I begged them to save my arm, and thankfully they did. But so that was the main extent of the injury. But I mean, I was laid out in flat in hospital for, you know, for weeks. I couldn't move. But
that's amazing.
It's amazing, but in all fairness, it's still a miracle that I didn't not only suffer worse injuries, but actually die, because the rail police, the National Rail Police, did a big inquiry on the whole accident, and, you know, because it was quite a biggie, and you know, they actually took the carriage down to London and stripped it, the doors right down to the last rivet, they told me. And when they finished their inquiries, which is a year later, they actually said to me, look, we're all banging our heads together still, because we all think you should not have survived that. We don't understand it. Well, we've done all our maths, and you should be dead. And I said, well, I know. And I thought, should I tell him? No. So something more powerful than me actually saved me that day and saved my life, you know, right. Which I went on to learn a bit more about as time went on.
Yeah, so let's dive into this. So you have these horrific injuries. Mm-hmm. You should have died, honestly, yes. Right? You should have been mashed to a pulp. But the result of that is in hospital, then you did have a near-death experience.
That's right, yeah. When they got me off the track and they got me to the back in ambulance, and then we went soaring down the highway, and then we arrived. And I remember arriving, just seeing this kind of like semicircle of doctors and medics all waiting for me, and then they just got to work on me. And because of my arm injury, especially, I was losing copious amounts of blood, you know, so there's a lot of blood loss at that point. And my family had arrived pretty soon after I had it, which is amazing how quick they got there. So that was all seemed quite surreal that they were there. I thought, wow, you know, the consultant said, look, your family are here. And I went, oh, right, you know. So they came in, and also my friend Anna was there as well, which is great, because all I wanted to do was touch base with her, because I knew we'd just been through something together, basically. You know, she'd been there and she'd watched me go under and everything. I just wanted to check.
Oh, how traumatic.
She was okay, you know. I was just so concerned for her. Yeah, exactly. It was because she assumed that I was dead as well, you know. Right. Anyhow, so I was in the hospital and I was just lying there and chatting to talking to my family were coming over. My mum was in tears, you know. And I was actually apologizing to her. I was going, Mom, it's always me causing all the dramas in this family, because it always was. And she was going, don't stop, you know, don't apologize and stuff. You know, it's not your fault, which it wasn't my fault. But, you know, anyway, it was that point in the emergency department that I suddenly left my body. And I left all the agony that I was in and all the high, you know, volume of noise and lighting and stuff. And I went to this beautiful, dark, but it felt like a lovely, warm, dark room at first, you know, and I was just lying there. And instead of being on the hospital trolley, I looked around and I was lying on this huge kind of slate rock. It was like a big medieval altar. And I thought, wow, what is this? You know, where am I? And it just felt really comfortable to lie on. You wouldn't think so, you know, but I was just lying there, and I suddenly realized it at that point as well, that I was not clothed anymore, because I looked to check out my injuries and stuff, and everything was intact. You know, there was no cuts, bruises, scars, or severed arms or anything. My arm was back in place, and I was lying there. My whole body looked very peaceful, and I thought, and I just laid back, and I suddenly looked around me, and there were all these beautiful pulsating colors all around me. They were like orbs that were just slowly pulsating just all around. And that kept me very calm, you know, because I just figured at that stage that I'd passed on. I thought, this is it. This is the next stage, you know, that I died.
You did have this consciousness realization that, okay, I'm not in my body anymore.
Yeah, well, I felt like I was still in my body, but I just felt like, but I wasn't. I knew that I wasn't in the earth plane, as it were. I wasn't back in the hospital. I knew I was somewhere else completely, in another sphere. And I just assumed that this was death, you know, that I'd gone, because there was, you know, at that point, there was every chance that I was going to die. But I was totally acceptant of it. You know, there was no kind of like sense of shock, or there was a total sense of calm and acceptance about the whole thing. And it felt right. It felt like for the first time in my life that I'd arrived in a place where I felt like me and felt I could accept myself for once, for the first time. And it was a wonderful feeling. And then I started to, I felt there was a presence with me that was nearby. And I looked at my feet, and then I suddenly saw this beautiful, like an androgynous being that was just stood at my feet with this kind of pure white blonde hair and this sort of alabaster skin, and just kind of, you know, and this amazing sort of warmth coming from and reassurance coming from this being. And I just thought, wow, I know you, and I've known you for a long time, haven't I? And I just felt this connection, like we'd known each other for all my life and beyond, you know. We were like, it was like my soulmate. It was like, wow, who are you? And I just felt so protected. And this being was just kind of looking at me and smiling with this, like a sort of knowing, protecting smile. And I just kind of laid my head back and smiled. And as I laid back, then I looked up, and there were like three grids of light suddenly above me, and kind of closing in slowly. And that the light that was coming from there was just like a pure white light, and it was like a healing light, basically. And I couldn't take my gaze away from it because it was such a beautiful light. And it's interesting because it was so bright that normally you wouldn't be able to look at that kind of light here on Earth, like sunlight or electric light. You know, it would be too bright. But with this, you could, and you didn't want to look away from it. And so I was just feeling this sense of love was suddenly embracing the whole of me. And at that point, I realized that there were two other beings either side of me, a female form. One was kind of like sort of brown hair, sort of green eyes, and was healing with her hands going over my body. And then another girl who was to the left, and she was more of either Asian Indian or American Indian sort of form, but very beautiful as well. The love that was coming from their hands was just, it was like this unconditional love was just transforming and going through. I could feel it going through every single part of my body, you know. Although, interestingly enough, it didn't feel like they were actually healing my body. It was more like they were healing my soul, you know. It's like my soul was being healed. And it wasn't just from the accident. It was just through years of self-loathing and feeling like a failure, and all that was just dispersing from me, from my whole soul, you know, that feeling. And I just felt great. And it was interesting, actually, because one of the things that I always carried around with me was guilt as well. Like I said to you, with my mother in the hospital, you know, that I always felt that it was me creating havoc. So as I lay there, I suddenly thought, oh, my family are going to be completely beside themselves now, because clearly I'm dead and they're going to be stood over my dead body and they're going to be distraught. But I didn't feel the same sense of guilt or even sort of like, oh my goodness, you know, it was just a sort of real calm, oh, I'll see if I can see them. So I looked over my left, over the side of this huge rock that was on, the slate rock, and hoping to see them in the hospital. But I didn't see them at all. But what I did see was this beautiful, incredible sight. And it was like a remarkable waterfall of stars that were just cascading over the edge and just slowly dropping down with shooting stars falling through the middle. And as I looked down, I thought, wow, you know, it was just the light was intense. But the light went from white, it was disappearing into other galaxies of different colors, you know. And it seemed like it was just going into infinity. You know, there was no end to it at all. The further, the more I looked, the further I could see. And so, of course, by that point, I realized that I wasn't actually in a darkened room whatsoever. I was literally in the universe itself, because, you know, that's where I was. So, yeah, it was really quite beautiful. And I just kind of turned my head over and I thought to myself, again, there was no sense of guilt. I just thought, oh, well, I'll be seeing my family. They'll be coming up here soon and they're going to be experiencing what I'm experiencing now. So everything's going to be fine. You know, there was no sense of like, oh dear, you know, so it was great. And so as I did roll over, I just kind of suddenly felt like this another energy that was getting very intense that felt like it was just closing in on me. And I looked, and then I could see this was the most amazing sight. There was this huge tunnel of white light was just kind of slowly closing in, coming very close. And this tunnel of white light was just surrounded by like flames that were circulating around, you know, beautiful colors of oranges and yellows and reds. But there were dramatic flames, but again, they weren't frightening, you know, just nothing. There was no sense of fear or anything whatsoever. And I didn't feel any fear from this. I just felt an absolute excitement because the energy coming from it was just like, was what I'd been feeling up until that point, but by tenfold. The love that was coming from that was really intense. And it's almost like every molecule of my body was just kind of almost like shaking with this feeling. And I immediately knew at that point that this was the source of all creation. You know, this was God. This was, you know, this is where it all comes from. This is, it's not the image of God that I've been used to seeing before, you know, on the Sistine Chapel or whatever. You know, this is it's a white tunnel of huge light and flames and energy. So, yeah. So, and then, you know, I laid back, and pretty much at that point, I was just full of all this joy. And then I suddenly came crashing back down to the hospital, and I was back to earth, you know, and I was back in my body and straight back into the pain threshold and all the noise and the light. It was like, whoa, wow, you know. So, yeah.
How long all told do you feel like that experience lasted? It sounds like it hours, but
it's interesting because it's a few people have asked me that, and the truth is there's no sense of time at all. There's no sense of worry or urgency or anything. You're not thinking about time. Time doesn't exist, and it felt infinite, really, you know, and it just felt like, you know, everything was just slowly falling into place, and everything happened just as it was meant to be. And, you know, and I was just, I realized as I look back that I was learning an awful lot. I was being given a lot of telepathic messages and knowledge, you know, while I was there. And, you know, like for example, realizing straight away that the tunnel of white light was the source of all creation, which I firmly believe still now, you know, if I pray really hard, that's what I focus on, you know, because that's where I feel it all stems.
Were you raised in a spiritual tradition? Did that?
No, not at all. Yeah. No? Well, interestingly enough, I was at first, actually, because both my parents were Christian, and they went to church each Sunday. And when I was little, you know, I went along with my brother and sister, and we met as a family. And interestingly enough, I never felt comfortable, and I didn't like being at church, and I just didn't get it. I didn't connect at all with any of the faith, and it just went straight over my head. And I didn't really feel comfortable with the whole thing, you know. And so my parents were really quite liberal, and they said, okay, look, you don't have to do this. You can stay at home. So I used to sit at home, you know, on my own when I was younger. So I was not anti-religion, but it was kind of like, because I'd had a young experience of it, it made me cut off from it. It didn't, you know, so there was no sense of believing in God or thinking about God, even, you know, like when I was going through my toughest times, my hardest times. When I hit the real rock bottom, that was the one point when I prayed, because I was just desperate, but it was a point of desperation. I didn't even know who I was praying to or what I was praying to, but it was just like, please, whoever's there, whatever you are, please, I need your help, you know. And it was just kind of like, it was a fear. So even at that point, I didn't really think, right, I'm praying to God now, or to Christ or Spirit or anything like that. Yeah. And so it was, all this, again, was a massive life turnaround for me, because, you know, I was given that knowledge instantly, and that instant hit of faith, you know.
And so did that change your view about faith? How did it change your view about faith?
Yeah, it did too. It changed immensely, actually. Yeah, I mean, firstly, I believe in the power of prayer now, because I experienced that. And there's a really interesting story, and that was, as the train had moved on eventually, and I was left lying in between the tracks, you know, my friend Anna was frantically trying to find someone to stop the train, you know, because that's the first thing you'd want to do. And they found a ticket guard or whatever, you know, and he alerted he pulled the lever or whatever, you know, and they stopped in the middle of the countryside. And she run through the carriage and saw me go under, so she believed I was dead. And so she turned around and said to this carriage where they were sat in this packed train of commuters, she said, my friend's just gone under the train. Would you mind if we say a prayer for him? And then she said, a lady stepped forward and said, look, I'm a Christian. Would you like me to take the prayers? And she said, yeah, please. So she told me that she took these prayers, and she said that it was incredible. She said everyone put down their laptops and their newspapers, all these people commuting from offices and stuff, and they all prayed for me. And you know what? I felt it when she told me that. I said, I felt those prayers. And my mum told me as well that a lot of the local churches around, because it was all over the local news that I'd gone under this train. That she said, my mum said that a lot of people have been praying for you in churches. I said, I know. I'm feeling it, you know. So prayers are really a very powerful thing. So, you know, so my faith is very, very much. I mean, it's not something like, you know, it's a very personal thing, I guess. You know, I mean, it's like I don't really go to church as such, but I do go to my spiritualist church for spiritual healing. But in saying that, that's my way of touching base as well with God and all the creators and all the ones who saved me, and, you know, all my guides, basically. So, yeah.
Yeah, that spiritualist church seems to have really been instrumental in your journey. You know?
Yeah, well, I was very keen to find it again after what had happened. Because I wanted to try and track down that medium. I wanted to find her. I thought, I've got to tell her what's happened. I'm going to say, look, you know. And it took me a while to trace her, but I couldn't even find the church. I couldn't even remember where it was. And I was recovering at my sister's when I came out of hospital for quite some time. And she used to sort of walk me into town when went to the river once I was able to get outside. And we used to go to the river. And one day we were walking back from the river after feeding the swans or whatever. And we walked through this like passageway. And I said, there it is. That's the place. There's the doorway. Because it's a very simple... It doesn't look like a church. It's just literally a doorway in a Victorian building, you know. And so I said, I'm going in. And there was a service literally on as we walked past. So, you know, so I walked in there. And it was great because, you know, they knew who I was from the news footage. And also I got all this stuff. There was like all this plastic holding my arm together at that point. So I went in and I'd had a coffee afterwards and stuff. And they got chatting to me, and it was brilliant because they got it straight away when I started talking about my near-death experience, and they go, oh we know about near-death experiences. And it was lovely. It was like affirmation. I didn't need confirmation, but it was nice to find somewhere where I could talk to
people who got it,
you know, and you felt at home with it. So it was great.
And then you went back for some healing sessions as well.
That's right, yeah. Right at the end of that service, somebody came over to me, one of the healers, and a lovely German lady called Maria, and she said, you look like you could do some healing. She said, we don't normally invite people because we like people to come of their own accord, but we do spiritual healing on Thursday evenings. I said, oh, great, yeah, I'll come. So, and at that, the healing that I was receiving was like incredible because it actually helped me with my physical recovery. I was going at tenfold once I started spiritual healing. And it was quite funny because, you know, I'd be going back into, you know, appointments with my consultant and he'd be saying, wow, you're healing really quick. This is incredible. You know, you're doing really well. And I started saying, yeah, well, you know why? And then I started telling him, and of course he's a scientist and he was like, we built up a good rapport, but you know, that was he was going, yeah, okay. As if to say that, don't tell me anymore. But
just, right. But we understand the power of spiritual healing, of course, the power of energy healing. It's huge.
Oh yeah.
We're energetic beings, so
yeah.
Of course it works.
So you know about it then yourself, yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm a Reiki master and a healer and I know that you know, when we allow the body to relax, the body knows how to heal itself very, very well. We just have to let it. And then, you know, when we make the space for it, it can happen. So I don't doubt the power of your story at all. And you've kept your arm. You live. Not only did you live, but you kept your arm.
I kept my arm, yeah.
Yeah, and you have use of it, not full use, but you do have use of it.
Yeah, it's remarkable, actually, yeah. When I went, when they took me through into theatre, I said, look, can you keep my arm, please? You know, I said, I play guitar, which I didn't play guitar that well, actually. It was just like, you know, basic three-chord wonder stuff. But I still, you know, I said, I want to carry on doing that, you know.
Said, yeah, you're in a punk band.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it was important to me. And so he said, I will. And he stuck to his word. And he did tell me afterwards, like, about, you know, a couple of months later that, you know, that they would have amputated, you know, immediately. It would have been a normal thing to have done because it was pretty much beyond repair. But he's, bless him, you know, he just started working at the hospital literally at that point. And I think he took me on as being like his kind of like, wow, this is project. his case study. You know, it was like one of his first big jobs was this guy who got under training. So, and so they took three major operations to save it, you know, and they had to kind of like, you know, because there were still, some of the tendons were still there that they could save that were still attached. So yeah. And I couldn't, you know, I couldn't even, when once they put it all back together, I mean, I couldn't use my hand, you know, my fingers at all. You know, they were just gripped into a fist, you know, because all the tendons are tightened up. But I had this, I was also meeting this really wonderful occupational therapist called Sarah. And she was really took to my story and my case, and we just got on really well. And we, in fact, we're still friends now because she's retired from the job, but so she means she can retain a friendship with me outside of the hospital. So she's in the book, she's there, she's great. So, but she was like very much a part of getting me to really stick at it, you know, really working at it to try and get my fingers open, manipulate, and get them to work again and stuff. So, yeah, so it's. I've got so much to thank for them. I mean, I'm laughing earlier about me talking about spirituality and healing to my consultant, but I've got, without my consultant, without all the science of their knowledge, I wouldn't be here chatting to you now because, you know, to me, they were able to save me with all their science. And so the two work hand in hand very much so, you know.
So I just have to ask, what is a consultant? I don't know that we have that term here in the States.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Do you know what? This happens sometimes, doesn't it? We have different words that almost fit in. Yeah. It's basically a surgeon. It's like the kind of, it's like the, but it's, I don't know whether it's the same in the States, but here, you know, the surgeon is basically, they're in charge of you and your whole case, you know, kind of like he was in charge of, he said to me he was going to get the best bones surgeon in to come and actually fix the bones in my arm together. And you know, there's all steel holding it together. But, you know, because it was completely shattered. You know, he said that when I saw the X-ray. It was just like this piece of metal going on my arm. It looked like all these pebbles, and that was basically my arm, you know. So they, and but this guy was one of the best in the country, and he said, "I'm going to get him. He's the only one who can do this," and he did, and he did a fantastic job. So, right. So yeah, basically, so the consultants are the head surgeons who are in charge of you.
Right. And you did become something of a local celebrity. I mean, everybody turned out to be on Team David, right? And there was even reform among the train company, the transit authority, right?
Yeah,
major changes.
That's right, yeah, which was one of the great things to come out of that. And I didn't even realize it. I was watching our late night BBC News. 10 o'clock, and it's like the main news, you know, and it just came on, and I just saw the flash where they go through the events that are coming up on the news bulletins, and they just said, the British Rail Police, whatever they're called, they'd have a name like, you know, BFI, whatever, you know, and they said they've come up with six major changes on the rail network, and I thought, oh, well, so look at this, you know, and I watched it, and then they interviewed this guy, you know, who was the head of the rail police, and he said, "Yeah, this is following an accident a year ago that we had to investigate where a man went under a train, and so they changed six major points, you know, and you know one of them was, you know, stopping this. Nobody would be able to, if they got their coat caught in the doors, that would never happen now, that they would get trapped, and they would be able to release it, the doors would open automatically, and also just things like, you know." There's so many alarm buttons and levers and everything above the doors inside that my friend Anna said that she couldn't reach half of them because, you know, she's not that tall. But also not only that, she said that you stand there when you're in shock, when you're panicking, and all you see is all these signs saying, "Do not press it. If you pull that, you get £100 fine." And you think, "Well, which one can I push? Which one is it? Which is it?" So now they've just got this one big red button, it's kind of like press, you know what I mean? It's a simple equation. So there's lots of different things. So I kind of smile to myself now whenever I do get on a train.
So you do get on trains now?
Yeah, I do. I had a lot of therapy to get there, but I was determined because I was told at first I wouldn't be able to drive again. So I figured, oh, well, I'm just going to be... But I didn't realize that. That was just a temporary thing, really. And then but anyway, at that point, I was just feeling like I can't just not be able to get anywhere. So I had a lot of therapy to help me get back to the station. I couldn't even get to the station. Going into the car park itself outside was a massive thing for me. And then eventually we did it stage by stage, got me on the platform. Then eventually I got on the train, and then now I can do it, yeah.
Wonderful. And so I have to ask, because I'm also a spiritual medium and talk to angels, all that type of stuff. Did you like ask those guides who met you in the near-death experience for help with this? Did they continue helping you with some of this PTSD and some of the healing that you're aware of?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, I'm fully aware of them being with me at all times. Yeah. And I connect with them a lot, in fact, you know, and it's something, come on, were you going to say something?
Yeah. How do you connect with them?
Yeah. Right. Well, sometimes it's through telepathy, and sometimes it's actually through talking to them. I'll actually talk out loud. Yeah. If something happens where I know that they've just done something, they've given me a sign they're there, I'll just literally go, "Hi, thank you. Thank you so much." And if something's gone well that I've been praying for and asking for their help on, I just turn around and thank them, you know. I say, "Thank you so much." You know, it's just, you know, to me, guides are there to help you. It's not like, you know, the old days of feeling like, you know, praying, you know, you've got to feel like, I mean, I'm humble when if I pray for their help, I'm humble, but only out of respect, because I would, in the same way as I would respect, say, yourself, if you were healing me and helping me, then I'd respect you, you know. So it's in that same way. It's not like in a sort of like, I am not worthy and all stuff like that, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm a mere mortal. I just kind of talk to them and connect with them, because I know that they want to help. They just want to give as much to all of us. And I believe and know that we've all got our own guides. And I wish I'd known this before, because it's something that we should just feel free to try and connect with them because they want to help us. You know, my guides have been there throughout my whole life previous. They didn't suddenly arrive at that point. That's what I realized. I just hadn't known it. And if I'd known it, I'm sure my life would have been a lot more bearable up until then. And so now it is. But yeah, so I connect with them. And, you know, there's little signals, little things that I've got to know that they're there. And they help me creatively as well. So,
yes,
which is something else that happened. You know.
Well, yes, we need to talk about that.
Sure.
Because some really amazing things came out of this near-death experience. I call them superpowers. I mean, reading your story, you got these super amazing superpowers. So what developed after your accident?
Right. Well, the starting point was literally as I came through from the first anesthetics, from the first operation. I was lying there on my own. They'd given me my own room in the hospital. I'm lying there in the dark with this little R2-D2 machine bleeping next to me. You know, we were both together lying there. And part of me was like thinking, wow, you know, where have I just been with that amazing place I went to? That was incredible. Part of me was dealing with the shock of what had happened with the accident.
Did you miss it? Like once you left, did you just like yearn to be back there?
No, I didn't do. That's interesting. Everyone says that to me. And I didn't, not at all, because I felt like I'd come back for a reason. I felt like I didn't know what it was. So all I could sense was, right, why did they send me back? I've got to find out why I've come back. And there's clearly a reason. So I was very keen to find out really, first of all, what that was. And secondly, I was very keen to record what I'd seen because I was so scared of losing, of forgetting it or getting missing some detail because it was such a big thing. I figured at that point that I was the only person that it had ever happened to because I'd never heard of near-death experiences before. So I thought it was just me who'd had this and that was it. So I thought, how am I going to tell the world? They all need to know that there's an afterlife.
Did you know that Radiate Wellness has a subscription-based premium content Facebook group? Think of it like the premium version of this free podcast. In this premium Facebook group, you can find great content like replays of online classes, meditations on angels, chakras, mindfulness, and more, guest speakers, mini classes, polls, plus you'll be the first to know of guests that we have scheduled for the podcast and can submit questions for them. You get all of this great content for one low monthly price, and the first month is half off. You can subscribe by going to radiatewellnesscommunity.com/shop. Click the subscriptions button, and you're in. Also, while I have your attention, wherever you're listening to this free podcast, if you could just do us a couple of favors, please. One is go to hit the subscribe or follow button. Then you'll be notified of all of the episodes we have coming out each week. Also, please rate and review. It sounds really simple, but it helps us to grow our audience when people are looking for great podcasts. And when we grow our audience, we can do bigger and better things and bring you even more great guests. So please do those couple of things, and that will help us grow this audience and this podcast. Thank you so much for listening.
You felt when you came back, you felt like you wanted to paint this experience.
That's right. Yeah.
Had you painted before?
No, not at all. I mean, I was always, you know, interested in drawing and stuff when I was younger, but because of my lack of, as I said, when I was at school, feeling like a bad boy and not getting any qualifications, I couldn't go onto art school or anything like that because you need to have qualifications. And so I'd never really followed it up, but it didn't matter because at this stage I thought, right, I've got to do come what may. It was like this telepathy telling me I'm going to paint what I'd seen. And that's the best way to describe it to everyone is by doing a huge canvas.
Wow. And in your book, you talk about that scene from Close Encounters of the Third Kind with Richard Dreyfuss, where he builds the Devil's Tower,
yes.
Doesn't know why, and all these, he's just obsessed with it.
Exactly. It's very much like that. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, again, because I'm dyslexic, I've never read any books, so it's all my references have always been about movies, because I used to go and see so many movies, and that was one of them, was that. And I thought about that film, I just thought it's so much like that. You know, there's this thing where you just kind of feel like, as I say, I knew nothing about near-death experiences, and I thought it was anything it had happened to. But I just thought I've got to try and do something. I was being encouraged, as it were, to pull this painting together. And so I started working on it. And I was apprehensive at first. I had this canvas leaning against the wall, and I thought, I got it. And I thought, when do I start? And then once I did, it all started coming together. You know, it just, I was being helped. I was channeling ideas through, which I still do now. And I just knew that that wasn't me that was putting all that paint and all those ideas onto that canvas. It was coming from somewhere else, and I was just so excited by this, and it just felt fantastic, and it was just a beautiful experience. And
you even manifested a studio to do this in.
Well, but basically what happened was that because I didn't know anybody at that point, you know, some friends of my sister's came around one day, and they own and run like a sort of a yoga and Pilates center. And they came in and Jane said to me, "Oh, when have you started that painting yet?" And I was going, "No, I can't. You know, there's not enough light in here, or you know, not enough space." And she said, "Well, we've got a room up in our attic, and we're not using it this week because we're closed. Why don't you come and do it there?" And I was going, "Okay." So I took it in there and I just started. Of course, I didn't finish by the end of that week, but she turned around and said, "Look, you can carry on. Don't worry." And I said, "But I thought you needed the room back." She said, "We'll work around you." So I ended up staying there for 2 years, free of charge, no rent. You know, and I just painted prolifically. So it's a very special place and very special friends to me, obviously, now those two.
I think everybody kind of got on board with your story when they saw just the miracles that were happening for you and the transformation. Sounds like people just came out of the woodworks to try to help you with it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wonderful. And so putting your experience on canvas, did it feel like the same? I know these things were flowing through you, but did you look at this canvas and say, "Yeah, that's exactly what it looked like"? Or was it a little different somehow?
Yeah, it was. It came together really well. You know, there was no sort of like... There's hardly any days when I'm like, "Oh no, this isn't working," and you know, "This is all looking wrong, and let's start again." It just developed each day, and I'd get to the stage where I'd literally start at the end of each day. I'd sit in a chair and I'd look up and I'd go, "Wow, look at that!" And that's when I knew to thank my guides. I used to look up and say, thank you so much. This is amazing, you know. So I knew they were helping me, so it was all channeling through. And people used to come up as well. This is really lovely. Who were coming into the center for yoga and Pilates groups, and I became known as the artist in the attic, you know. People would come up and say, "Oh, what's going on with this painting?" So they want to know what it was, and so there was quite a lot of people who were fascinated by the whole spiritual aspect of it, and so. Which was great, because I got to know a cellist, and she was playing cello for the local orchestra. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, "Oh, do you mind if we use one of your paintings for our next poster?" And I said, "Yeah, that'd be great." So she just used like a section of it for the poster and stuff. So we became really good friends. I was still going for spiritual healing. Some of the healers are mediums, and they give me messages sometimes at the end, just short ones, you know, that they were picking up as they were healing me. But they were like something. At one point, there seemed to be this common thread that was coming through from various mediums, and they're telling me that you're going to write some music. Why am I seeing a violin placed across your chest? I was going, "I don't know." And then one of them said, "Well, you're going to write a piece of music about your experience. That's what they're telling me." I went, "Right." So I went back home and I couldn't play guitar anymore because, unfortunately, even though they saved my arm, it was not saved well enough to be able to do that. But that was fine, because I'd got this old cheap little synthesizer. It was I pulled out the cupboard, as it were, and I had that on the table. And I thought I was going to be writing a 3-minute song, because that's all I'd ever known, you know, playing punk pop or whatever you want to call it, you know. And so I was trying to write this song, and it just wasn't happening. It wasn't coming. And the only thing that did come through was this one lyric in this for the chorus, which I really liked, and it was "Shine On," and these words kept coming through, "Shine On," and so that stuck. So and but that's as far as that.
Title of your book.
That's the title of the book. Yeah, I went because I thought that's got to be the title, because it's just that was coming through from spirit, you know. And I was sat there in my apartment, and I was just playing around one afternoon, and this little chord progression, as you might say, came through, and I thought, wow, that's really nice. So I recorded it. I just got a little cheap cassette recorder at that point, and I just recorded it on that, and then started developing in it. And I thought, well, actually, this is not going to be a 3-minute song. This sounds like it should be played by an orchestra. So I spoke to my friend, the cellist, and we were having coffee together. She said, "What have you been up to?" And I told her about this, and she was very spiritual as well. And she said, "Well, maybe we could play it one day in the orchestra, you know." And I thought, that'd be nice. So that encouraged me just to, again, have the same courage to, in the same way as when I was doing the paintings, to think, right, why not? Let's do it. Let's write a piece of music for orchestra. So I did. So I developed it up, and my brother gave me this package which I could attach to my computer, and he said, "Like, if you plug this in, you can have it." And he said, "Then when you play the your music, instead of recording onto a cassette, it'll record it digitally, and then it can, if you want, it can transform it as notation." And so that's what I did. And so and then I got it all printed off, told my friend, met for a coffee with her, and she said, "Oh, this looks really good." And then somebody else, a couple of heads from the orchestra came and met, and they said, "Yeah, let's do it."
Listen to that, must have been amazing.
It was, yeah. It was one of the most beautiful, powerful experiences for me that still stays with me now. And the very first rehearsal that I walked into, again, just like the painting at first, you know, I'm only human. I was totally, there was apprehension of, is this going to work, you know? And I walked in, and I remember the conductor was there, and all this orchestra were rehearsing something else, and I just thought, crikey, it's quite daunting, you know. And he said, "Oh, the composer's here." And I was going, "Composer, yeah,
where?"
Yeah, it's me, you know. And then he said, "David, would you like to say a few words about your piece?" And I said, no, that's fine." So, but he said, "No, come on." So I did start talking, and when I looked at this orchestra, they were all very highly educated, you know, middle-class background, and I was coming from a working-class blue-collar background, and I thought, I'm out of my depth here, you know. And I just started talking about the piece, and because it was about my near-death experience, I probably didn't explain that, but the piece was, again, it was about my near-death experience, called The Divine Light. And so I started talking about it, and they just were very captive, and everyone was very interested to hear all about it, asking me questions and firing all sorts of stuff at me. And funnily enough, I knew that they were helping me. I knew I was being guided, that my guides were just saying, "Come on, just take your time and just, you know, be you and go for it." And so I did. And then I stepped back, and then the first opening bars came in of the first movement, and it moved me. in the same way as looking at my paintings. It was like it wasn't me. It was like listening to something else that somebody else had written. And it was this beautiful moment because I thought, wow, that's those few chords that I was just playing on, that little synthesizer that afternoon, is now... Now it's this beautiful three-dimensional sound, you know.
Amazing. And so when this music came to you, it came to you after the session. Now, I don't know if you know Dr. Eben Alexander, who wrote Proof of Heaven. Mm-hmm. He had experienced music in his near-death experience, and then he's devoted himself to try to find a way to recreate that music. Oh. Did you hear music in your near-death experience?
No, I did not actually when I was in the near-death experience itself. But again, what I've realized throughout my time since is that a lot of... When you asked me earlier how I felt, did I miss being back in that place? I felt like a big part of me was still attached to it. Part of me was still there, you know. Part of my soul was still... in that place, and it feels like it still is as well. You know, there's this link that continues with you. So I realized that there was the knowledge and the intensity of the knowledge that I was learning when I was there at that point wasn't all coming through to me at that actual time. It was afterwards when I was here that the knowledge was starting to come through. So I realized that the music that I was channeling and the artwork that I was channeling was coming through now. It wasn't what I'd heard or seen in the other side. You know, it was just kind of like it was just coming through now. I'm being given like a crash course by the best possible teachers there are, you know. It's especially with the music. I mean, you know, I didn't realize, again, I went in with it with full courage, thinking, right, I can pull this off. And I remember I spoke to, because I wanted to have somebody sing the final movement.
Sure.
Because I wanted to have some lyrics. Again, it was coming through from spirit telling me, oh, I'm going to have someone sing the last part. And so I went to this guy who I knew was one of the best sort of tenor singers in Cambridge. And he knew my parents. So I went to see him to see if he could recommend somebody to sing it. So I took the score along and he said, these chords you've got here, they're really unusual. He said, you would never see, I forget what it was, something like a C major with a D flat or whatever, you know, they're together. No one would do that normally, but it works. I was going, oh, thanks, you know. He said, this is brilliant. And I said, well, I'm sure you've written plenty of stuff yourself. He said, no. He said, I would never attempt to write a symphony for orchestra. He said, I said, really? I said, why? He said, no way. He said, I wouldn't know where to start. And he's like, you know, he's classically trained, and it's like, and a few of them have said that to me, that they've never really approached that idea, because it's amazing how I was given this knowledge. And I realize just how remarkable the knowledge was that was coming through to be able to make me understand how various instruments work together, you know, because, you know, people can go to university to learn how to sort of, you know, study composition in classical music, because it's a very complex thing, but I don't allow myself to stop and think about it in those terms. You know, I don't get too much into the theory of it. In fact, I don't at all.
Right, absolutely. And because it is pretty complex, but you didn't know how hard it was going to be.
No.
You know, what could that just makes me think, what could we do if we didn't worry about not being able to do it?
Exactly, yeah. And this is it, you know, this, you know, when I think of me now and me before, previous, you know, that I had no self-confidence or no self-worth whatsoever. And, you know, and a lot of that was knocked out of me basically at school because, as I say, because my failings failings, that was their words, failings in, you know, sort of not getting the qualifications that I needed. And, but now my life is something creative and three-dimensional. I use that word a lot, don't I? But it is. And purely because I've got that self-confidence and self-worth, you know, self-love. And that's the most important thing, I think, all of us, you know, not all of us can take a bit of that, isn't it? There's, you know, there's nothing lost.
You know? Yeah. So you described yourself before the accident as having failings, dyslexia, yeah. being kind of a loser. How do you describe yourself now?
Fulfilled, basically. I'm just fulfilled in what I'm doing. And I'd also say that I'm still very much stuck to a kind of mission, a plan, if you like, right from that first moment when I came back of thinking, why have they sent me back? What is my goal? What I still feel I've got this kind of sense of purpose to try and get across to as many people as I can what I experienced and get it across to people that there's nothing to fear, that death is not the end, you know, that life just carries on. The soul doesn't just switch off like a light switch, you know, it continues on to the next phase, and the next phase is very beautiful. And so there's a sense of mission about me, I guess,
Well, then the topic of this episode is radiate self-love. It sounds like that's this self-love has truly transformed you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Very different. You started painting, of course. You started wanting to paint your experience and then moved on to symphonies. And not only didn't just make one painting or write one symphony. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just looking at some of these materials about your background. Over 40 paintings and commissioned artworks. So yeah. People are asking and seeking you out. And then in terms of the symphonies, you had the Divine Light, which had its premiere concert, which was completely sold out.
Yeah. Standing up
and, wow. Wow. And then you've had further classical pieces commissioned and premiered at sellout concerts.
Yeah. So, I know it's incredible, isn't it? But it's just, again, it's just that kind of that one thing where, you know, one person happened to be playing clarinet in the Divine Light, went back to a group that they were playing in, and then they caught there was one group called the Cambridge Clarinet Choir, and they were just literally a group of 10 players, and they're all different sized clarinets. I never knew there was all different clarinets, but there's a bass one which is about 6 foot in length, and it sounds like an ocean liner coming into New York Harbor or whatever. They commissioned me to write a piece, and so again, I thought, well, I don't even know where I'm starting because I don't even know. I went to meet them, and I said, can I just hear you all play? Can I see all the different instruments? So I'll get an idea. And that was enough. And I went back and I did it. I pulled it out of the bag and wrote something for them. And they wanted me to write something spiritual. They said, oh, we'd heard off our clarinet, one of our members who played in the Divine Light, that your piece was really beautiful and we'd like you to write something spiritual for us. Is that okay? I was going, yeah, that's great. So I did. So that was also based on my near-death experience. And so that's called Awake. So that was just really lovely because you've got some beautiful harmonies coming out of these instruments and stuff. So it was quite plaintive. So it was really, so it's interesting.
Goodness. So you've taken on painting as a new career, and then classical symphonies as a new career, and writing, authorship.
That's the next stage. Wow. Yeah. So, which is interesting, you know, because again, when I was going to this, when I first joined the Spiritualist Church, I used to go to them services every Sunday, and after each service, we'd have a guest medium would come from various parts of the country and do what we call a platform here and stand up for half an hour. And I was getting picked out nearly every week. I think it's because I still got this very strong spiritual connection from the other side. And so they were kind of like, they didn't know who I was because these were people from different parts of the country. So they didn't know. And it was, they were incredible. And and I've forgotten exactly what I was going to tell you.
That's all right.
I'm going to say, it'll come back to me in a moment, I'm sure.
No worries. Now your life, you're very connected with the other side. You're connected with your guides. Mm-hmm. You channel music, art, through them a book, you channeled a book through them. And so what is your daily spiritual practice like with them? Or do you have one?
I don't have like a daily practice, to be honest with you. That's something that I've always felt comfortable with by not needing to. The only practice I have is weekly practice of going to a spiritualist church to have spiritual healing. So that's the one time where I actually know that that's my time. Every Thursday evening I go there, and that's where I connect. And it's, I always call it being plugged into the mains. You know, I just kind of feel like I'm really connecting with spirit and all my guides full on, and with, you know, and the energy coming through from the healing is really, really wonderful and really powerful. So that's my only time that I actually do that. So it's all very spontaneous, basically. So if I connect with spirit, it's just when I need to, or it doesn't have to be anything big. It can be for something small that I'm concerned about or anxious about. I'll connect with them and ask them and stuff, you know. So that's how it works. And I've remembered what I was talking about now. If you...
Please.
Yes. It was when you talked about the book that I was going to say that when I was going... And the mediums were turning around, picking me out each week. They were turning around, quite a few of them, saying that they're telling me that you're going to write something down, and you know they're showing me like a computer, a laptop, and a keyboard, and saying you've got to start writing. And I just thought, if only, you know what I mean? I thought it's going to take me a lifetime. So I kind of put that one on the back burner, and I just focused on all the music and the art. And then suddenly I thought, no, this has got to happen. This story has got to come out. And it did. It just started coming together. A friend of mine got in touch with me, who I've known for years, and we hadn't been in touch for ages. And so she said, what's happening? And I talked about my story and wanted to write it. She said, well, look, let's get it together. She said, she said, I'll ghostwrite it for you. So that's what she did. So she came in. Otherwise, I would not have been able to have completed the whole book on my own. So you know, it's basically my story, and it's all written from my perspective. It's all me. But she's, you know, managed to pull it together and stuff and work with me. So again, it all happened very organically. That, you know, I decided to get in. I thought, well, let's try. I might get in touch with Raymond Moody, Dr. Moody, because the first near-death experience painting I'd done, I sent an email to him because I didn't even know who he was or how big he was. I just looked through the internet at that point and I found him. I thought, he does studies into near-death experiences. I'll send him my painting. And he got back to me. He said, this is brilliant. This is a great painting. And I thought, by now I knew just how big he was in the whole field of near-death experiences. So I thought, well, maybe I'll send him a copy of the book now, see if he'll read it. And so, you know, I did do. And I heard nothing back at all. And then, like, a few months later, his manager got in touch and said, I've just come across your email here. And you know, Dr. Moody gets so many, he will have overlooked it. But I've just looked at your website and I've just looked at the whole, your artwork and your music, and it's brilliant. I know he's going to love this. So can you give us some more time? I said, yeah, of course. So he read it, and his manager got back and said, he loves it. He thinks it's great. And he said, I think he's going to, you know, write an endorsement for you when it comes out. I said, oh, that'd be brilliant. So and then, yeah, but he went from an endorsement to then she said, actually, he's now saying he's going to write the foreword for it. I was going, brilliant. So I didn't use that at all to get any leverage out of publishers, because I'd approached another publisher and they turned me down, but they thought it was good. They just said it wasn't for them. And so they passed it over to this other guy at my publishers, and he read it through and he said, I love it. And I'd really like to take you on. Can I take it to the meeting with the rest of our team? I said, yeah, sure. You know? And so they said, yeah, straight away. And so that came in again, very organically. It wasn't something that I was like pursuing and chasing after. And so, yeah, so all these things you talked earlier about, you know, I was being sort of supported by the community and stuff, but I really believe that it's kind of, it's like a bigger picture than that, that it's, that I'm being supported by my guides, you know, that they're helping to make these people step into my pathway and stuff, and be there and be part of it, a part of the journey and stuff. And I just didn't realize just how much, you know, Raymond Moody, he's such a lovely person, and I just appreciate him for what he's worth as a soul, for what he's done and stuff. But obviously other people have turned around, I've done interviews, especially, you know, in the US, and people say, wow, Dr. Raymond Moody, I mean, like, he's the, you know, he's the big one, you know. And I go, well, yeah, but he's just an amazing person. He's just, I'm just happy to have met him as a soul, you know.
Right, yeah. Right. Just to have him write the foreword was absolutely wonderful. You know, of course, he endorsed the book. There are some other really wonderful endorsements that you've gotten of it. So I can't wait for it to actually be out in the world June 26th. 2020. Yeah. We're trying to time this episode so that it comes out just prior to that launch date. Do you have any big plans for the launch?
I don't know what's going to be at the moment, because obviously, you know, with the whole thing with the COVID and the lockdown, it's changing by the day here, just in entirely what we're going to be doing. So first of all, I was planning that it was just going to be maybe a virtual sort of Zoom launch, but do you know what? It's not something that I'm really thinking about that much, because I just kind of feel like it's very hard for me to kind of go, yeah, the book's coming out. And it's like, yeah, let's have a big party. I just want to let it really, you know, something will happen and something will come together that day that will fit accordingly. Do you know what I mean? I'm not making any big plans to do anything with it. It's getting very exciting. I mean, you know, we're getting lots of interest and people pre-ordering it and stuff, which is great, you know. So that, and in the US as well, it's great. There's a lot of people very interested there, which is lovely. But I met so many amazing souls just by doing interviews, you know. And I'm really saying that from my heart. You know, there's been some fantastic people that I've come across. It's been a wonderful part of this journey, you know, because now I felt like my music and my art was speaking basically for me before. I was doing interviews, but not to quite this extent, whereas now I'm talking like to the likes of yourself more openly about the whole thing, and that's great, because it's, you know, the power of word is now a new aspect to sort of bringing the story out there to everybody. So yeah.
I did have a question about how your story may have changed your circle. I know you had a couple of good mates that, you know, that were also manual laborers, and yeah, you had your circle of friends and your family and everything. Did they accept the new David after your experience?
Those two mates of mine, I think they found it a bit, you know, they did, but they, you know, the gears were grinding a bit for them, because they always knew me as I was before, you know, and it was a bit more like, come on, let's go and have a drink kind of thing. And they could see that I was no longer that person. But they were good souls. They really loved it. But my family, it's interesting because, they were very accepting of it. And I was scared of telling my parents actually about my near-death experience at first, because of their, as I said earlier in the conversation, because they'd gone to a Christian church, I just thought, they're probably not going to get this and they're not going to believe it. Because I'd actually met the priest in the hospital and spoke. He was one of the first people that I spoke to, and I could tell that he wasn't getting it. He was just thinking, no, this doesn't come into my teachings. He more or less said that to me, you know, this, you know. And I thought, my parents are going to feel the same. But so it took me a week to tell them. But when I did, my mum and dad listened through the whole story. And then my mother turned around and she said, yeah, we know. And I said, you know? I said, how do you know? And so I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, it's just that your dad and I have been saying, whenever we come in, you're on in this bed that you can hardly move. You've got tubes coming out of you. You've got nurses around you. But you're just glowing. You've got this kind of energy that's giving out to people around you. And you just like, it's like everyone who's around you, it's like you're helping them. And I said, wow, that's incredible. You know? And it was interesting because other people used to come in and say, yeah, you're really animated and things like that about me. And so from that moment onwards, you know, it was like, right up until, like, my mom and dad are in the book, you know, because we decided to do some witness statements where I asked people, I interviewed them and asked them what they thought about, you know, me and how it changed my life and stuff like that. So my mother, sadly, she passed away last year. So it's really lovely to be able to look back on her words and what she said. And it was it's really, really beautiful. But yeah, so they've been very excited about it all, and they really get it. And it's quite interesting because they also said to me, I think my dad turned around and said, we never really talk about the afterlife in church, you know, because I asked him about this. Did you ever talk about things like this in the Christian church? I said, no, it's only Jesus, you know, about Easter, you know, about, you know, the Reformation stuff or whatever. So it was interesting. So for them, it's lovely, and it was lovely to be able to give that.
Your story is not counter to Christianity. It doesn't negate anything. It doesn't, you know, it's not. Yeah, it's just not counter to Christianity. I mean, you definitely saw God. You were surrounded by beings. We could call them angels. We can call them guides. But there's nothing that is, you know, negating anything about Christianity.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I don't, you know, I've walked into my parents' church a couple of times when I've taken them in and out, and everybody in there, they are lovely souls, and they're all aiming towards the same thing as me, you know, which is God and Christ and stuff. But, you know, but it's just a different way. It's just like all religions, you know, they've all just got different methods of prayer and that's their faith, and so I respect it, but it's just a different thing. It's just the one thing about my faith is that I don't feel like there's any rules, basically. You know what I mean? There's no sense of feeling like, as I said earlier, that you're not worthy and that you're praying from a lower level. And you know, we're all loved. We're all very loved souls. And I think that needs to come across more. And that's what my own faith is. That's what I find. When I go to healing, when I come out, I just feel like I've walked out of there feeling like I've been given lots of love and unconditional love, just like I was when I was being healed, when I was in the other plane, you know. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's certainly a beautiful story. And I can tell that it's really transformed you quite a bit. I'm just so grateful that you were able to take this experience and bring such beautiful things into the world. And this message of self-love, this message of peace, this message of hope, this message that we are all loved. It's thank you. Thank you. Oh,
you're welcome. Thank you for having me along. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. So I wish you much success, much luck with this book as it's coming out. And I'll definitely be looking for it to appear online.
Yeah, sure. Please do. Yeah, am I allowed to mention the website so people
can
have a look? Yeah, fantastic. I never want a hard sell, but I am doing. So yeah, it's if people want to go to my website, it's basically shineonthestory.com. So if you go there and you'll find everything on there. You'll be able to stream the Divine Light for free. You can listen to the music and then you can look at the paintings and you can go to links for my, you know, other things like the book. You know, there'll be a thing you can click on there, a link wherever you are in the world, and you'll be able to pre-order it there, you know, through whichever, like Amazon and stuff like that, all those different things. So you can pre-order it there. And
shine on.
Yeah, so please come and have a look on there. shineonthestory.com.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you, David. Thank you for meeting with me today. It's been such a pleasure. I just adore your story.
Thanks a lot. Mm-hmm.
Radiate Wellness is a community of holistic and alternative healers and consultants based in the Kansas City area, dedicated to helping you create spiritual, energetic, and physical well-being. To learn more about our practitioners, services, classes, and events, or to schedule an appointment, visit us at radiatewellnesscommunity.com.
I'm Rachel Corpus, an angel communicator, psychic medium, and host of the Angel Talk podcast. This show is meant to help you remember who you are, a limitless being with shoes and socks on. And along the way, we'll connect to people on the other side and experts in the field like authors, healers, animal communicators, and more. Listen to all my shows at Mind Body Spirit FM or wherever you get your podcasts.